As Derek has already said, we're continuing our study as we're looking through John. And the passage I've got for today is John 7, verses 14 to 24, which is following on from what Gordon was speaking about last week. But to make sense of it, I think we need to go back to the start of chapter 7. So I'm going to read, but I'm going to read from chapter 7, verse 1. It says, "After this, Jesus went around in Galilee, purposefully staying away from Judea, because the Jews there were waiting to take his life. But when the Jewish Feast of Tabernacles was near, Jesus' brothers said to him, 'You ought to leave here and go to Judea, so that your disciples may see the miracles you do. No one who wants to become a public figure acts in secret. Since you're doing these things, show yourself to the world.' For even his brothers did not believe in him. Therefore Jesus told them, 'The right time for me has not yet come. For you, any time is right. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me, because I testify that what it does is evil. You go to the feast. I'm not yet going up to this feast, because for me, the right time has not yet come.' Having said this, he stayed in Galilee. However, after his brothers had left for the feast, he went also, not publicly, but in secret. Now, at the feast, the Jews were watching for him and asking, 'Where is that man?' Among the crowds, there was widespread whispering about him. Some said, 'He's a good man.' Others replied, 'No, he deceives the people.' But no one would say anything publicly about him for fear of the Jews. Not until halfway through the feast did Jesus go up to the temple courts and begin to teach. The Jews were amazed and asked, 'How did this man get such learning without having studied?' Jesus answered, 'My teaching is not my own. It comes from him who sent me. If anyone chooses to do God's will, he will find out whether my teaching comes from God or whether I speak on my own. He who speaks on his own does so to gain honor for himself. But he who works for the honor of the one who sent him is a man of truth. There is nothing false about him. Has not Moses given you the law? Yet not one of you keeps the law. Why are you trying to kill me?' 'You're demon-possessed,' the crowd answered. 'Who's trying to kill you?' Jesus said to them, 'I did one miracle, and you are all astonished. Yet because Moses gave you the circumcision, though actually it didn't come from Moses but from the patriarchs, you circumcise a child on the Sabbath. Now, if a child can be circumcised on the Sabbath, so that the law of Moses may not be broken, why are you angry with me for healing the whole man on the Sabbath? Stop judging by mere appearances and make a right judgment.'" So let's do a quick recap as we start off. Jesus was in Galilee, up in the north of Israel, around Cana, Nazareth, Capernaum, beside the Sea of Galilee. And it tells us in verse 1 that he was staying away from Judea, Judea being down in the south, around Bethlehem and Jerusalem, because the Jews were waiting to take his life. However, the Feast of the Tabernacles was approaching, and his brothers suggested that he ought to go down to Judea, meaning he should go to the temple in Jerusalem. But why did they want him to go? Verse 3 to 5 says, "So that your disciples may see the miracles you perform, and that he can become a public figure." But in the light of verse 5, it also says, his brothers didn't believe in him. So that advice wasn't given to him sincerely. It was just something that they wanted to do. And Jesus replies by saying, the time is not yet right. It's not God's time for me yet to go up to the feast. So his brother set off to the feast without him. And the Feast of Tabernacles lasted for 7 days. And as Gordon was speaking about it last week, it celebrates the completion of the harvest and commemorates God's goodness to the Israelites while they wandered throughout the desert. And even today, Jews will set up, don't quite know how to describe it, a shelter, a temporary shelter in their garden or around their house or beside the synagogues that they go to, in which they'll eat various meals where they will worship God in that shelter that they've created and sing songs and prayers to remind them of the time that they had spent in the wilderness. So that would probably all have been going on around the area of Jerusalem and that at the time as well. But Jesus then decides to follow his brothers. And at first it tells us he remains unobtrusive for the first little section that he's up there until halfway through the festival. And it's suggested that probably by halfway through the festival would be when the biggest crowds were around the temple and that anyway. So we're speaking about the third or fourth day into this 7 day period of the festival of the tabernacles, that he goes up to the temple courts and he begins to teach. And the first thing that we see is that the Jews were amazed at his teaching. That is something that's occurred in other passages in the gospel as well. So the Jews were amazed at his teaching, saying in verse 15, "How did this man get such learning without having studied?" And to fill in a little bit on that, most Jewish teachers and rabbis studied under a recognized rabbi before they could go out and do any teaching themselves. But obviously, Jesus had never done this. But he replies in verse 60, saying to them that actually he did have a rabbi. "My teaching comes from the one who sent me." So in that, he was saying to them, "My rabbi is actually God the Father. It's him who's giving me the teaching. My teaching comes from him who sent me." God the Father was his rabbi, and he was there only to do God's will. And his statement in verse 19 must have incensed the rulers and the leaders even more when he says to them, "Not one of you keeps the law of Moses." That was one of the most important things in a Jew's life, was to be able to keep the law, to follow the commandments that had been set down, even although they've added and added and added to those. The Jews congratulated themselves on being God's chosen people and the recipient of the law, and they were so proud of that and so much wanted to keep the law that they did all these add-ons to it as well. But then the crowds respond that he's demon-possessed by what he said. And they're asking, "Who's trying to kill you?" And there's various different people or within this passage, and I'll get to that a bit later. But Jesus then illustrates why the Jews actually broke the law of Moses, criticizing them, and they say they were criticizing him for healing the lame man on the Sabbath, but it was okay for them to circumcise a male child on the Sabbath. Because if you go back to Leviticus, it tells us that a male child had to be circumcised on the eighth day. And they took the law of that so literally that it was the eighth day. Couldn't be the seventh day, couldn't be the ninth day, had to be the eighth day. So whether that was a normal day or whether that was a Sabbath day, it didn't matter. It was supposed to have been done on the eighth day, the day on which the Pharisees would say no work was to be done at all. And that exception is important in trying to understand the the controversy that's spoken about here in verses 21 and 23. Jesus was not saying that the Sabbath should not be observed or that the Jewish regulations were too harsh. He was saying that his opponents didn't understand the significance of the Sabbath. The command to circumcise showed that sometimes work could not only might be done on the Sabbath, but sometimes had to be done. It was not work on the Sabbath that was wrong, but the type of work that was done. So things like deeds of mercy and the circumcision and the healing that Jesus had done on the lame man should have been allowed. But the religious leaders of the time had become so strict on those things that they were saying all of that was wrong and no work was allowed on the Sabbath at all. I just want to take a moment now to look at the groups of people that's actually involved in this, because it's a bit strange as you're reading it as well when it's speaking about the Jews and the crowds and things like that as well. So from the start, we've actually got four different groups of people that are here. There's one, Jesus' brothers right at the start, who's asking Jesus to go off to the Festival of the Tabernacles with him. They try to get him to the festival, really to push him into the limelight from what they were saying. You must go now so as that the crowds can see all the miracles that you are doing. So they were trying to push him out there to make him a public figure, which he wasn't right for at that stage. Then it speaks about the Jews. And by that, they're actually meaning the Jewish leaders and the people within Jerusalem at that time. This included the Pharisees and the Sadducees, who differed theologically as well with what they believed, but they did agree on one thing: their opposition to Jesus and their desire to get rid of him. So we've got Jesus' brothers, we've got the Jewish leaders and the Jews within Jerusalem itself, then we've got the crowd. The people who had come to Jerusalem to celebrate the festival, but didn't normally live there. They would probably not have been up to date with all that had been happening in Jerusalem, and that can be seen to a certain extent in verse 20 when they're saying, "Who's trying to kill you?" Obviously, all the crowd that had come into Jerusalem to celebrate the festival wasn't aware of what had been going on. So they then say to Jesus, "Oh, you must be demon-possessed. Why is people wanting to kill you? Who's trying to kill you? There's nothing that we know of that's going on around there." But even within that, as we're looking at verses 11 to 13, there was obviously speculation going on in all these different groups as well. It says in verse 11, "Now at the feast, the Jews were watching for him and asking, 'Where's that man?' So they were expecting him to be there, but he hadn't appeared yet." And in verse 12, saying there, "Even among the crowds, there was a widespread whispering about him." So even those who had just come to Jerusalem to celebrate the Festival of the Tabernacles had obviously heard of him and something of what they were doing, because it says, "Even among the crowds, there was a widespread whispering about him. Some said, 'He's a good man.' Others replied, 'No, he deceives the people.'" And when Jesus then stands up to speak, at first the debate was with the Jews about where his teaching came from, but the crowd actually joined in the discussion as well. Jesus had boldly said and announced to the leaders that they wanted to kill him because he'd violated the Sabbath and claimed to be God. If you want, you can go back and have a look at John 5, verses 10 to 18. That's where all this comes from. But the crowd, however, didn't know the leaders were out to kill him, so they challenged this statement of said to him and thought instead, "Oh, you must be demon-possessed. This is just nonsense that you're telling us about." But all three of these groups judged Jesus on what seemed to be a superficial examination. They were all judging him based on what they were seeing. But to me, the most important bit of this whole section comes right at the end, right at the verse 24, where Jesus says to them at the end of what he's saying there, stop judging on appearances and make a right judgment. Stop judging on appearances, but make a right judgment. And unfortunately, I think we're all very similar in what we do today. We make judgments and decisions hundreds of times a day. And I'd just like to read to you a couple of stories that I've got for you. If you've heard them before, you'll just have to bear with me, but I think it fits in with what I'm speaking about today. The first one is about a pastor who transformed himself into a homeless person, and he went to the 10,000 member church that he was going to be introduced to as the head pastor that morning. So he got to the church and walked around for about 30 minutes before the service was about to start, while everybody was beginning to file in and find their seats and get ready for the service. And he said, only 3 people of about the 7,000 people that were there at that stage even spoke to him. And he asked, like a beggar would, for change to buy food. And nobody would give him anything. No one in the church would give him any change or anything. So he went into the sanctuary and decided to sit down in the front seat. But the ushers came to him and said, no, you can't sit there. And they led him and they put him in a seat at the back. So the service actually started, and the people started worshiping, and then it was time, the elders went up to the front and said, we're going to introduce our new pastor to you. And as they said that, the people started shouting and clapping, but there was no sign of anybody from within the church that was going to step forward. And at that stage, this dirty, homeless man from the back stood up and started walking down to the front. And with that, the whole church went silent. And it's just a question of, it was something totally unexpected for them. They didn't think that this homeless, dirty tramp who'd come into their church that morning could be their new minister. And it's just a way of looking at people and how we judge people by what they do, rather than even by what they say. And the second story is one that was on a website concerning Tony Campolo, who's a pastor in the United States. And it says here, one day around noon, when he was walking down Chestnut Street in Philadelphia, he noticed a homeless man coming straight towards him. Tony was wearing one of his best suits. The tramp was wearing layer upon layer of filthy clothing. His most obvious feature, however, was a tangled beard that nearly hung down to his waist. Bits of rotting food were stuck in his beard. The teeth he had left were yellow and rotted. He was holding on to a cup of McDonald's coffee in his hand, and as he staggered towards Campolo, he said, "Hey, minister, you want some of my coffee?" As you can imagine, Campolo really didn't want any of his coffee, but he reconsidered and then said, "Okay." So he took a small sip and handed the cup of coffee back to the man. And he said to the man, "You're feeling pretty generous today. What's got into you?" The man answered back, "Well, I figure if God gives you something good, you ought to share it with someone else." And Tony Campolo then thought, uh-oh, he's getting ready to hit me for $5 or something. So, knowing it was what he was supposed to do, Campolo said, "Well, you shared your coffee with me. Is there anything I can do for you?" "Yeah," came back the reply from the tramp, "there is." Campolo started to reach for his wallet. "Can you give me a hug?" the man replied. Campolo said he now kind of wished that he'd asked him for money instead. But he put his arms around the man, and the man hugged him back and didn't let go. There were all kinds of business people in Philadelphia that morning, streaming around them, where these two men, a man in a suit and a man in rags, were hugging one another on the sidewalk. And again, what would we have done in that situation? Would we have taken a sip of his coffee? Would we have given him a hug? We're all guilty of judging by appearance, perhaps not to the same extent as the examples I've given in the stories. But when we first meet someone, we tend to look them over and we can automatically just pigeonhole people. You know, we see somebody, we judge them by their appearance. We can judge them by how neat and tidy they look, how clean they are. Do they have a nice appearance? Are they somebody like me? That can all be something that we think about when we see people. Or it could be more along physical lines. It could be how tall or short they are, how fat and thin they are, whether they're white or black, whether they're young or old. We make all of those decisions automatically when we come into contact with people. That's without them even saying anything. When they open their mouths, we can be thinking, oh, he's Scottish, or he's English, oh, she's foreign, oh, she's from Liverpool, she's a Geordie, anything like that. It's all things that happen to us almost without thinking about it. All these things go through our mind or through our relationship. Seems automatic that we do these judgments, and as I say, we do it without thinking. And it's not thinking these things that's wrong. It's what we say or do based upon these initial perceptions of people that we come in contact to. But in verse 24, it says here, Jesus asks us to make a right judgment, not on appearances. And how do we make a right judgment? We can only do that by getting to know the person a bit better and the situation that they're in and finding out more about them, by carrying on a conversation with them or whatever. But unlike what happens to most of us, we maybe need to listen more than we talk and to find out what's going on first before we open our mouth. As we said, we've got two ears and only one mouth, so maybe the listening should take more preference over the talking. Because when we look at it, everyone is created in God's sight. Everyone is equal in God's sight, and no one is more important than anyone else. And God loves us all equally. Matthew 7:12 urges us, as Jesus says, "So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you." That's something that we follow on a day-to-day basis. And another one that's often quoted is out of Matthew 25, verses 35 onwards, when it says, "I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you invited me in. I needed clothes and you clothed me. I was sick and you looked after me. I was in prison and you came to visit me." How good are we at looking at those in situations that we come into contact with? on a day-to-day basis? Or do we just not notice at all? Or do we barge in and say something and then regret what we said 2 minutes later when we find out the situation is completely different from what we actually thought it was? So what I want to leave you with today is just by saying, as we go into the world this week, look at the situations that we encounter, whether it's even at home with family, because even in a church situation, we judge almost instantly on what happens. You see someone that's coming to church that you maybe don't know. Are they saved? Are they not saved? If it's outside, are they a Christian? Are they a Muslim? Are they Hindu? Are they a JW in Christian circles? Are they charismatic? Are they Baptist? Are they Anglican? Are they Catholic? It all goes to what we think in general of the person that we come into contact with. But is that the way Jesus would look at the person that we come into? We make these judgments all the time, and we make them without thinking about it. So as we go into the world this week, let's not look for opportunities to judge those that we come into contact by, just by looking at appearances or what we think the situation might be. But let's look for opportunities to judge rightly and to serve others as God brings opportunities into us. As people cross our paths this week, going back to what was used quite a few years ago, let's think, what would Jesus do in this situation? Not what would I do, or how can I get out of this situation that I'm in that I don't really want to be in, but what would Jesus do? How can I show his love to those that I come into contact with this week? For we're only here through God's grace and God's mercy that he's poured out upon us. And the situations that people get into, yes, it can be consequences of things that have happened in their life. But it may be something that they're trying their best to get out of as well and need help from those that are around us and perhaps not getting that help. So whatever situation we find ourselves in this week, whether we're meeting people that we know or people that are strangers that we come into contact with, just look for opportunities to serve them in whatever way we can, that we can be Jesus and show Jesus' love to those that we encounter day by day this week. Amen.